We were sitting in the site office one evening thinking it was time for tea when we got this extraordinary call, the rock's talking to us.
This rock was the Cambrian slate of the Eladir Fawr mountain in North Wales, and hidden inside it was Europe's biggest construction project.
We all piled down into the cavern, and we stood in the access tunnel just adjacent to the works in total darkness apart from the cap lamps, and listened, just stood in this silence. And you don't know how long you're standing there because the time sort of markers had disappeared. And within a few minutes, we heard this noise, just like a roaring lion, a few meters to our right. And your instinct, your personal instinct, because you're sitting there with a quarter of a mile of rock above your head, was to run like hell out to the open.
But his professional instinct as a civil engineer was to find out what was causing the rock to speak and uncover the secrets that lay inside Electric Mountain. Welcome to Engineering Matters. I'm Bernadette Ballantyne.
And I'm Johnny Dowling. For this episode, we've partnered with consultant Mott MacDonald to hear the story of the design and construction of one of the most important clean energy storage projects ever undertaken.
The Dunorwig Pumped Storage Hydropower Project in North Wales in the UK pushed the limits of power station design and construction in every conceivable way.
The scale of the underground works include vast caverns, tall enough to house 16-storey buildings and a 16-kilometre network of enormous tunnels, up to 10.5 metres in diameter, requiring the removal of 3 million cubic metres of rock.
Designers were stretched to the limits of engineering, which led to new British standards for rock reinforcement and state-of-the-art concrete tunnel design. At its peak in the late 1970s, 3,000 people, mainly local, from 33 different companies, came together to do something that had never been done before.
They successfully hollowed out a mountain of slate and delivered the biggest pumped storage hydropower project in Europe.
A project that changed the way that the UK's grid system was operated and immediately began saving the Central Electricity Generating Board, CEGB, £50 million a year.
The speed and scale of its power generating capacity was breathtaking.
It could bring 1,320 megawatts of generating capacity online within 10 seconds, making this the fastest frequency response rate in the world.
40 years later, this remains world leading, and it can deliver its total 1,728 megawatts of generating capacity within 16 seconds and maintain this for over 5 hours.
And its flexibility means that today it's providing a critical role in balancing out intermittency from renewable energy.
People don't know, it's kept the lights on in England and Wales for 40 odd years. And it looks as good now as it did 40 years ago. It has been really well maintained.
This is James Arthur. We heard his voice at the start of this episode.
In the early 1970s, James was working in Glasgow as a civil engineer for a consultancy called James Williamson and Partners,
which became part of Mott MacDonald in 1990.
And when I got up there, I found the most extraordinary company of incredibly competent engineers.
Engineers chosen by the CEGB to investigate, plan, and design their most important project.
A project so large that it was the biggest construction contract ever awarded in the UK. The CEGB encouraged contractors to form consortia, and the winner was a joint venture of the UK Sir Alfred McAlpine, tunnelling firm Charles Brand,
and Swiss rock blasting firm Konrad Schocker.
This became known as MBZ.
I ended up as a sort of key person putting together the design of the tunnels and the design of the rock support that holds those caverns up. And to say it was amazing is an understatement.
As James says, the project has been operational for 40 years after being formally switched on by Prince Charles, now King Charles, on the 9th of May 1984. But there were many other milestones. To celebrate the success of the excavation of the Machine Hall in 1979, the Carnarvon Male Voice Choir were invited to perform.
This hymn, Tidi Arodaist, is a song of hope, written by Clamberis-born Thomas Rowland Hughes, whose father was a quarryman at Dinorwig's slate quarry. This was one of the largest quarries in the world, with slate of fantastic quality. But falling demand meant that it closed just before the pumped storage project began, and this closure was devastating for the local economy.
It was critical then that the new project created local jobs. And once the environmental objections were resolved by placing the infrastructure underground, the local authority, Carnarvon County Council, insisted that at least 70% of the labour was local.
The local feeling in the end was quite positive.
This is Dyfrig Roberts.
I joined James Williamson and Partners back in 1969 as an assistant engineer.
He was one of the first people from Williamson's, as it was known, to work on the scheme.
Lots of people, local people, had been working at Wilver, and that had long finished and they were short of work. And quality work with quality salaries was few and far between.
Wilver was a nuclear power station built nearby on Anglesey during the 1960s, which opened in 1971. James Williamson and Partners also worked there as a designer.
So there was a clause, the CGB put in a clause, where I think that 70 or 80% of labour employed by the contractors had to be local. And that was a great card to play with the local people in their getting their support for the power station.
For Williamson's, it meant opening a new, larger office at Colwyn Bay from the previous base at Cladudno Junction.
The CGB and Williamson's worked closely together, and they were looking to repeat a pump storage scheme that they had already built in Scotland on the banks of Loch Awe, the Cruachan scheme. They were looking to build a similar station in North Wales.
Similar, but four times larger.
And it was very important that we were able to talk openly to the residents about what we were planning, because, to be fair, a number of them were quite concerned when they heard that the CGB were planning on a power station in their area. Because then there were two stations. There was Trawsfynydd and there was Wilver, and both were nuclear power stations. And there was concern. People didn't know what a pump storage scheme was. People didn't know the subtle differences between a hydro scheme and a pump storage scheme.
Pumped storage hydropower happens in a closed system. Water falls from an upper reservoir through generating turbines into a lower reservoir and is sent back up again when there is excess power on the system.
Unlike traditional hydropower, which relies on natural recharge of the water system for generation.
In the case of Dinorwig, the proximity to the nuclear power stations in Wales was important because this new large-scale pumped storage scheme was needed specifically to store excess nuclear power.
Its primary design concept, of course, was that it was built as a battery to store energy.
Chris Roberts was a commissioning engineer for the CEGB.
At that time had more inflexible nuclear power stations on the grid system. And at night we had baseload stations, nuclear power stations, generating electricity, which were really surplus to demand.
The system needed a mechanism to store this nuclear power.
By building the Dinorwig, each machine absorbed 295 megawatts. So by building Dinorwig, we created quite a significant demand on the system at night, and we were then capable of generating electricity during the day.
specifically at times where the load was peaking, negating the need to keep expensive thermal plants on standby, and in this way, it fundamentally changed the way that the grid was operated.
At the time, James Bond films were very popular, and people would get up during the commercial breaks and go and make themselves a cup of tea. And it was quite remarkable to see the swings in demand during a James Bond film.
It could also provide fast emergency response if any of the large-scale baseload generating assets suddenly came offline.
It was also used for frequency regulation. The grid system supplies electricity, which is controlled at 50 cycles per second, alternating current. And that's a figure that they stick rigidly to. And if the frequency goes up, they take power stations offline. And if the frequency goes below 50, they bring power stations on. Whereas with Dinorwic, they could just regulate the load at Dinorwic and control the frequency on the grid system.
Dinorwic can still be used for these purposes today, but the system has changed massively as coal generation and nuclear power have made way for renewable energy.
The operation at Dinorwic is 24 hours. We have a control room, we have a dispatch system, so the instructions come in from the trading team, from National Grid, and those are checked to make sure that they're compliant, so our machines can actually deliver what's being asked of them, and then that is transferred onto the interface with the machines, and the machines are started up or transitioned from one mode to another mode.
John Armstrong is the station manager for First Hydro, which is the owner of Dinorwic, following privatisation of the electricity market in 1990.
So common application would be around the morning, the breakfast peak and the evening peak. So as people finish work or starting, you know, waking up and starting kind of like breakfast and that type of thing. So you get a peak of activity in the morning, and then the grid operator will have units either in spin gen or generating within. So a lot of activity in that peak to make sure that we're accommodating any kind of changes in demand.
Spin gen or spin pump are the fastest response modes because the turbines are already spinning in air, meaning that when the inlet valves open, generation takes just a few seconds.
But it also operates in generation and pumping mode as well as shutdown. John estimates that its flexibility means it switches between these different operating modes around 25,000 times a year.
Meaning that at 40 years old, it has done this over 1 million times.
Today, it's not so much about absorbing nuclear baseload as it is about providing essential storage and grid balancing functions for renewable generation.
It's more about weather. So that as we've transitioned into renewable energy in the UK, we respond a lot to the kind of requirements to make sure that this renewable energy can generation can operate. So the wind stops blowing, you know, but we can and the generation from renewable energy drops. You know, the clouds go over solar farms, you know, these PV farms. And we can step into that shortfall very quickly. So yeah, we run in this kind of backup mode, spin gen, and if that shortfall occurs, then we can very quickly transition to generate and put, you know, megawatts onto the system.
Of course, engineers back in the early 1970s could not have predicted this adaptation to renewable energy. But Dinorwic was built with flexibility in mind and quality in delivery.
Initially, in 1970, Dinorwic was one of three sites under consideration.
The site investigation at Dinorwic and all the other sites was so important because one was able to try and assess the conditions we would be meeting up with when we were creating the machine halls. Bearing in mind that the machine hall at Dinorwic, when you speak to a layperson, you tell them that you created a hole that was half the width of a football field, it was twice the length of a football field, and it was tall enough to construct a 16-storey building.
The machine hall is 180 metres long, 24 metres wide and 60 metres high. And an excavation of this size had never been attempted in this kind of slate before, which could be jointed and fractured.
What is more, there were another 8 caverns and more than 16 kilometres of tunnel that also had to be built.
There was a phenomenal meterage of cores taken out, so much so that they were stored in a small power station the CGB had in Dolgarrog.
These cores gave engineers like James Arthur information about the Cambrian slate, which helped them calculate how to support it as the caverns were excavated.
The work was so groundbreaking, it contributed to a new British standard for rock reinforcement.
Basically, nobody had tried to enumerate the design of rock reinforcement. And that is what James Williamson and partners, with me sort of stirring the pot in the middle, actually managed to achieve.
Until this time, rock reinforcement using sprayed concrete and rock bolts was done according to practical experience.
The original idea was precedent practice. What had somebody done before that worked? What we ended up with was a fraction, considerably less than originally envisaged amount, and an enormous saving in the cost of the project and also in the time, because it's time consuming to put in.
Rock bolts basically transfer any potential unstable loads from the exterior of an excavation into the more stable interior of the rock.
But on this project, the team took a much more analytical approach.
This was in part triggered by a very early collapse at an access tunnel.
Early one Tuesday in 1974, 2,000 tons of slate suddenly gave way. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, but the CEGB and its engineers were determined to learn from this failure.
We all had to sit down and work out how to do this. And what they hadn't done was to take into account the joints in the rock. And I can remember that first diagram that appeared on my desk all those years ago. And you could see where it was going to fail. It was obvious without any shadow of doubt that was designed to fail when you plotted the joints on it. So we started learning.
Academics were brought in from the country's leading universities, including Cardiff and Imperial College.
I found myself coordinating this amazing team of very intelligent, very practical, experienced people who were just out to achieve what nobody had ever achieved before, because there was no precedent.
Trials of the rock reinforcement system involving 12-metre-long steel bolts known as rock anchors were carried out in the machine hall. These primary supports were 40 millimetres in diameter and placed every 6 metres and tensioned to 600 kilonewtons. Smaller 25 millimetre bars were used as a secondary support, driven in 3.7 metres deep every 2 metres.
And basically what we did was to be very conservative, stuff big McAlloy bars up into the rock, tension them, and then slacken off the tension little bit by little bit to see what happened. And each day, at the end of the work, the surveyors went in and did very, very hyper-accurate surveying. So they had all the lights off and the ventilation off. And at one point, we were sitting in the site office one evening thinking it was time for tea, when we got this extraordinary call, the rock's talking to us. And at that point, we all piled down into the cavern, and we stood in the access tunnel just adjacent to the works in total darkness apart from the cap lamps, and listened, just stood in this silence. And you don't know how long you're standing there, because the time sort of markers had disappeared. And within a few minutes, we heard this noise, just like a roaring lion, a few metres to our right. And your instinct, your personal instinct, because you're sitting there with a quarter of a mile of rock above your head, was to run like hell out to the open. Your professional instinct was to say, what on earth's causing that?
The project surveyor, Ian Waite, asked himself the same question. He was responsible for setting out the entire project, monitoring the works, the position of underground infrastructure, and tracking any movement.
He remembers the incident well.
We were measuring these anchors to see if anything was moving after they'd loosened them. And there were just two of us. We were about 20 metres away from each other. I heard the rock going crack like that, you know? And we didn't say anything to each other. We then, 5 minutes later, we heard it crack again, you know? And then we both ran to each other. Did you hear that? Yes, we heard that.
Ian duly reported these findings to James's boss, Tom Douglas, the chief designer, who brought the team into the tunnel to hear it for themselves.
No one knew what it was, so they said, well, we went out again and then come back tomorrow and take the same measurements again and see if anything had moved. And it hadn't, so I don't think anybody knew what it was. It must just have been the rock relaxing. You know, but it was, they heard it, so it wasn't just a matter of us telling them the story, because they heard it as well.
James has his own theory.
We observed a little bit of water flow on the right-hand side the next morning. And we think, because there was a pilot tunnel down the roof of the machine hall, it acted like an organ pipe, mechanical, it was a mechanical amplification. We think that's what the cause was. We don't know, but we did go on and we built those caverns.
Building the caverns was just one of the multitude of activities that had to be carried out in order to deliver Electric Mountain. Some of the preparatory works were massive schemes of their own in really difficult conditions.
At the top of the site is the upper reservoir, which stores the water needed to generate power. Known as Märklin Mauer, this had to be enlarged to hold the 7 million cubic metres of water that would flow through the turbines.
Märklin used to provide local water supply to the area. We took that away from Welsh Water, so we had to give them an alternative. So there's an alternative lake further up the in the Snowdonia.
Robin Thomas has worked at De Norwegg for 47 years. He joined the project as a civil engineering technician for James Williamson and Partners in September 1976. Today, he looks after maintenance work on site, whilst geotechnical colleagues in Colwyn Bay continue to support the project with regular monitoring activities.
I basically joined the company from a small local contracting company, thinking I would maybe do a couple of years, but it's lasted a bit longer.
Robin remembers accessing the alternative lake for Welsh Water called for the construction of a new 15-mile-long water supply pipeline. And this would be difficult anywhere, let alone through mountains. Then there were all of the new access roads, including the conversion of an old railway line into a road to bring in aggregates and then a plethora of storage facilities. This was before they could get started on building a new dam at Märklin.
The actual lake invert was probably still the same. Now, there was a local quarries just down below Märklin where we then excavated slate and took it up the hill in order to construct the dam, which is now 600 metres long and about 30 metres higher than the original.
The original rock dam, built over 4 years in the 1970s, was raised in 2007. To further increase the capacity of the reservoir to 10 million cubic metres.
You can now view it from Anglesey, actually, and just see the top of the dam. Following on then from the dam, you have a horizontal, more or less horizontal tunnel, mile and a quarter long, to transfer the water, which then reaches what we call the surge pond.
This circular low-pressure tunnel is absolutely enormous, at 10.5 metres in diameter. And this then meets a 9.5 metre diameter vertical surge shaft.
Which then drops down 500 metres.
The total height of the surge shaft, including the surge pond at the top, which alleviates any pressure waves created when the inlet valve closes, is 548 metres.
Which makes it, I think, the tallest structure in the UK.
Officially, the tallest structure in the UK is the Shard in London, which is 310 metres.
Even today, this would be a difficult structure to create. Engineers back in the 1970s developed a new, ingenious method.
Kin Almond was the supervising civil engineer who employed Robin at De Norwig. He remembers construction of the shaft clearly.
A pilot hole was drilled down, 11-inch hole for the high-pressure shaft.
Drilled down half a kilometre to where the shaft meets the high-pressure tunnel at its base.
And then a 2.4-metre hole was augured up to the top, and then drilling rigs on a special framework and so on were constructed at the top, and they were manoeuvred down, drilling, blasting, mucking out through the holes. I think there were four rigs on a platform that drilled, blasted, and then they had back actors on a platform that's all suspended from the top, and the back actors scraped the debris and pushed it down the holes, down to the bottom of the high-pressure shaft, into the high-pressure tunnel, where they had low loaders and dump trucks.
These blasted rocks were then transported to the lower reservoir at Lyn Peris and placed over the silt at the bottom of the lake.
So that during operating procedures, in later days, of course, it kept the silt from getting into the water in the tunnels, and, you know, kept the water clearer.
Reusing the excavated rock on site was also good for the environment. Although this activity went well, it wasn't all plain sailing.
Well, that it might sound simple in those terms, but actually, during the work, the pilot holes didn't go down vertically and accurately. They veered off to the site.
Ian, the project surveyor, remembers this too.
We set it out at the top, and then when they got down to the bottom, we went and checked where it was, you know. And it was about, I think it was about 4 meters out from where it was meant to be.
Because the drill bit had been deflected by the slate as it descended.
Attempts were made to correct it, but unsuccessfully. So what happened? We had to drill another pilot hole, you know, sort of close by alongside it. And eventually it worked.
After the water falls through this vertical high-pressure shaft, it enters a 9.5-metre diameter high-pressure tunnel before flowing into a manifold where the water is split off into 6 3.8-metre diameter tunnels. This part of the system is all lined with concrete.
Upon entering the power station complex, 6 steel-lined high-pressure penstocks transport the flow to the inlet valves, which control flow into the turbines. These take just 5 seconds to open when the instruction to generate is given.
Then the water passes through to the turbine, obviously spins the turbine, which then turns the generator, and the water then dissipates down through the draft 2 valve gallery and then through 3 tunnels into the lower lake. And obviously you can reverse the whole system.
This system was the result of some detailed, extensive hydraulic design led by an engineer from James Williamson and Partners called Robert Buchanan.
He and his team worked with academia to make sure that the hydraulics were perfect. This involved the creation of scale models created at the University of Aberdeen. Several options were considered for the system, including a kind of dualling of the system, splitting off the flow from Macklin into 2 low-pressure tunnels. But in the end, it was the economics that determined construction of a single tunnel.
With the design sound, another Glasgow-based civil engineer called John Cowie then had to work out the concrete specifications.
History had taught him that earlier hydraulic tunnels had issues with voids in the concrete. John studied this carefully, determined to learn from the past.
I don't think it was the problem of the concrete, but it was the problem of the placing method.
This was critical for the project, where 1 million tonnes of concrete will be used to line the tunnels and caverns with thicknesses of between 300 and 1,000 millimetres.
That focused my mind on, firstly, how do you place the concrete? And secondly, what kind of mix of concrete goes into the hydraulic tunnels? And I think they got it right.
The concrete needed to be high strength, C40 at De Norwijk, meaning that its compressive strength is 40 megapascals. But it also had to be pliable enough that it could be applied hydraulically, using pumping to prevent the air voids affecting earlier tunnels.
What's more, the CEGB wanted the team to incorporate one of their waste products, residue from coal-fired power stations known as pulverised fuel ash, or pozzolan.
It was concluded after a lot of concrete testing that we could get the strengths, we could get the cohesion. You know, when you pump concrete, if you don't have the right amount of cohesion, it splatters out as a series of stones.
The PFA helped to improve the properties of the concrete.
Whereas if you had cement and pozzolan, this fly ash mix, it made it more cohesive, it made it more pumpable. You could add more water to it and not lose strength. There was an inherent advantage that the fly ash combined with the free cement to fix the cement so that the water didn't erode it.
And this increases the long-term strength. It was a win-win in concrete terms.
With this part of the puzzle complete, there was then the issue of application. Kin remembers this well.
Well, the technique for the tunnels was pretty much the same throughout.
For all of the tunnels, high-quality steel shutters were used as a formwork to ensure that the concrete was placed uniformly with a smooth finish. To create such enormous tunnels, the shutters were also huge, weighing 20 tons each. They had to be brought in from Milan.
These steel liners were made in Italy by a firm called Cifa, C-I-F-A, I think it was, yes. They would close up to be able to move them up to the next pour, and then they would be opened out to their final shape with hydraulic rams. And to move the shutter, they had a pulley system which pulled them up on rails which were laid on the invert concrete. And having got the shutters in place, which had little doors in them, hatches, through which concrete was pumped. And they also had ports at the crown of the shutter, which concrete was pumped through, so that you've got a really tight filling of between the formwork and the rock.
The shutters would vibrate to ensure an even application,
which again provided a smooth, beautifully smooth finish to the concrete. So the only joints were between each pour of the concrete.
It would then be left for a day to allow the concrete to begin curing before the shutters could be closed, and the system pulled along the rails before they could be reopened, ready to pour the next section of lining.
And that's how it went on, right up the tunnel. And that was the basic way of doing it.
Of course, the true test of a successful project is how it performs over time and under maximum load conditions. John Cowie retired in 1998, but he continues to think about the work he did at Electric Mountain.
That was the project of my life. It was, without doubt.
What he'd like most of all is to return to the mountain of Elliðaárfjall to see for himself how his designs stood the test of time.
Now, I would dearly love to go to De Norwijk. I'll tell you why. One of the great problems of a hydraulic system is that from time to time you need to dewater it to inspect it. Now, that's the point at which a hydraulic lining, a concrete hydraulic lining, faces its maximum load due to water pressure from outside. I would like to know the condition of their concrete and steel linings.
When the tunnels are full of water, any pressure from water outside the structure is equalized. But remove the water from inside the tunnel, and suddenly it faces massive loading. At its deepest point, at the base of the surge shaft, the water pressure is thought to be around 60 bar.
So has the site been dewatered? Have these tunnels faced their maximum loading conditions? Did John's work and that of his colleagues stand the test of time?
Understandably, dewatering De Norwig is not a decision that John Armstrong of First Hydro took lightly.
We went through a spectrum of we will never dewater, because dewatering takes the whole power station out of operation, so you've got no water for the turbines.
The problem for John was that the mechanical and electrical plant had a 40-year design life, and it was time to begin replacing some of the components, starting with the 6 main inlet valves that control the flow of water into the turbines.
There was no other way. They needed to dewater.
So we had to really get everyone comfortable that we weren't going to risk, first of all, for the asset, so the civil structure would survive dewatering, so we had to be absolutely assured of that. We had to also, you know, take some assurance that we would have a business to come back to.
The team went back to the original designs.
So we did a lot of work. We looked at a lot of the original stress calculations, construction of the vertical shaft and the penstocks, and the drain down process that was documented. Then we went out to third parties to make sure that their assessments and using, you know, finite element analysis of the structure aligned with our kind of understanding.
From this, they calculated that it would be safe to drain down the system over 11 days, equating to a rate of around 1 meter per hour. This then enabled them to carry out the first stage in the replanting program, replacing inlet valves 1 and 2.
So we changed 2 valves in 2023, and the plan is to replace the remaining 4 valves in 2025.
So how did the tunnels fare during the dewatering?
The hydraulic system was in fantastic condition. You know, I think there is a glaze coating on concrete when it's newly constructed, and that had been, you know, eroded or taken away, but there was no damage to the concrete structure. There was no damage from draining down, and there was no damage really that we saw from generation. You know, so it was a great testament to the guys who had constructed it and the techniques they used and materials that they used.
During a discussion at the Institution of Civil Engineers in 1985, the CEGB revealed that the capital cost of the project was £425 million.
The largest contract ever awarded in the UK. But the project immediately began saving the system operator millions of pounds. 50 million per year to be exact, giving a payback period of less than 9 years.
This is testament to the value of investing in long-term, clean, flexible energy generation and storage.
And to the quality of the work of the delivery team, many of whom say this was by far the most important project of their lives.
I think the designers and the team that constructed it should be really proud. You know, I think it delivered exactly what it was set out to deliver and support the grid system back in the 80s and 90s. I think they built in the redundancy and the flexibility so that it's been able to reinvent itself as the markets change. So I think they did a fantastic job.
Engineering Matters is a production of Reedy Media. This episode was produced by Bernadette Ballantyne and hosted by Bernadette Ballantyne and me, Johnny Dowling. Editing by Will North. Series supervision by John Young and sound engineering by Ross McPherson. And our own power generator is Rory Harris.
Special thanks to episode partner Mott MacDonald, Dinorwig's owner First Hydro, and the Carnarvon Male Voice Choir. Additional thanks to Dovrig Roberts for his help with the Welsh pronunciations, John Cowie for his detailed explanation of the concrete design and his encyclopedic knowledge of the history of James Williamson and Partners, Chris Roberts for his insights into why Dinorwig was built, Kin Almond for his incredible memory of the construction methods, Ian Waite for keeping everything where it should be, James Arthur for his dramatic flair and fantastic rock design, Ian Flower for his memories and insight, and of course the award-winning Robin Thomas, who's been diligently supporting the power station for over four decades.